Years were dying off like flies. 1975 looked like the last chance. Had not 200 of the church's best intellectuals spent 20 years examining the Bible, and hadn't this date been their unanimous conclusion? Had they not read between the lines in Daniel, scanned for the hidden meaning in Revelation, correctly identified the Asian Wars, Korea and Vietnam, as the period spoken of by the angel, a time and times and half a time? Hortense was convinced these were the sign of signs. These were the final days. There were 8 months to the end of the world. Hardly enough time. There were banners to be made, articles to be written. Will the Lord forgive the Ornanist? Doorsteps to be trod, bells to be rung. There was Darkus to think about, who could not walk to the fridge without assistance. How was he to make it to the kingdom of the Lord? And in all, Clara must lend a hand. There was no time for boys, for Ryan Tops, for skulking around, for adolescent angst. For Clara was not like other teenagers. She was the Lord's child, Hortense's miracle baby. Hortense was all of 48 when she heard the Lord's voice while gutting a fish one morning, Montego Bay, 1955. Straight away, she threw down the marlin, caught the trolley car home, and submitted to her least favorite activity in order to conceive the child he had asked for. Why had the Lord waited so long? Because the Lord wanted to show Hortense a miracle. For Hortense had been a miracle child herself, born in the middle of the legendary Kingston earthquake 1907. When everybody else was busy dying, miracles ran in the family. Hortense saw it this way. If she could come into this world in the middle of a ground shaker, as parts of Montego Bay slipped into the sea and fires came down from the mountains, then nobody had no excuses about nothing nor how. She liked to say, "Being born is the hardest part. Once you done that, no problems." So now that Clara was here, old enough to help her with doorstepping, administration, writing speeches and all the varied business of the Church of the Jehovah's Witnesses, she'd better get on with it. No time for boys. This child's work was just beginning. Hortense, born while Jamaica crumbled, did not accept apocalypse before one's 19th birthday as any excuse for tardiness. Yet strangely, and possibly because of Jehovah's well-documented penchant for moving in a mysterious manner, it was in performing the business of the Lord that Clara eventually met Ryan Tops face to face. The youth group of the Lambeth Kingdom Hall had been sent doorstepping on a Sunday morning, separating the sheep from the goats, Matthew 25:31-46, and Clara, detesting the young witness men with their bad ties and softly spoken voices, had set off alone with their own suitcase to ring bells along Creighton Road. The first few doors she received, the usual pained faces, nice women shooing her away as politely as possible, making sure they didn't get too close, scared they might catch religion like an infection. As she got into the poorer end of the street, the reaction became more aggressive. Shouts came from windows or behind closed doors.
"If that's the bloody Jehovah's Witnesses, tell them to piss off."
Or more imaginatively, "Sorry, love, don't you know what day it is? It's Sunday, innit? I'm knackered. I've spent all week creating the land and oceans. It's me day of rest." At number 75, she spent an hour with a 14-year-old physics whiz called Colin, who wanted to intellectually disprove the existence of God while looking up her skirt. Then she rang number 87, and Ryan Tops answered.
"Yeah?"
He stood there in all his red-headed black polo neck glory, his lip curled in a snarl.
I...
She tried desperately to forget what she was wearing, a white shirt complete with throat ruffle, plaid knee-length skirt, and sash that proudly stated, "Nearer my God to thee."
"You want something?" said Ryan, taking a fierce drag of a dying cigarette. "Or something?"
Clara tried her widest buck-toothed smile and went on to autopilot.
"Morning to you, sir. I am from the Lambeth Kingdom Hall, where we, the witnesses of Jehovah, are waiting for the Lord to come and grace us with his holy presence once more, as it did briefly, but sadly, invisibly, in the year of our Father, 1914. We believe that when he makes himself known, he will be bringing with him the threefold fires of hell in Armageddon, that day when precious few will be saved. Are you interested in..."
"What?" Clara, close to tears at the shame of it, tried again.
"Are you interested in the teachings of Jehovah?"
"You what?"
in Jehovah, in the teachings of the Lord. You see, it's like a staircase.
Clara's last resort was always her mother's metaphor of the holy steps.
I see that you're walking down and there's a missing step coming. I'm just telling you, watch your step. Me just want to share heaven with you. Me no want to see you broke up your legs.
Ryan Topps leant against the doorframe and looked at her for a long time through his red fringe. Clara felt she was closing in on herself like a telescope. It was only moments, surely, before she disappeared entirely.
I have some materials I've reading for your perusal.
She fumbled with the lock of the suitcase, flipped the catch with her thumb, but neglected to hold the other side of the case. 50 copies of the Watchtower spilled over the doorstep.
Why, me can't do nothing right today.
She fell to the ground in a rush to pick them up and scraped the skin off her left knee.
Ow! Your name's Clara, said Ryan slowly. You're from our school, ain't you?
Yes, man,
said Clara, so jubilant he remembered her name that she forgot the pain.
St. Jude's. I know what it's called.
Clara went as red as black people get and looked at the floor.
Hopeless Causes, Saint of,
said Ryan, picking something surreptitiously from his nose and flicking it into a flower pot.
IRA, the lot of them.
Ryan surveyed the long figure of Clara once more, spending an inordinate amount of time on two sizable breasts, the outline of their raised nipples just discernible through white polyester.
You best come in,
he said finally, lowering his gaze to inspect the bleeding knee.
Put something on that.
That very afternoon there were furtive fumblings on Ryan's couch, which went a good deal further than one might expect of a Christian girl, and the devil won another easy hand in God's poker game. Things were tweaked and pushed and pulled, and by the time the bell rang for end of school Monday, Ryan Topps and Clara Bowden, much to their school's collective disgust, were more or less an item. As the St. Jude's phraseology went, they were dealing with each other. Was it everything that Clara, in all her sweaty adolescent invention, had imagined? Well, dealing with Ryan turned out to consist of three major pastimes. In order of importance, admiring Ryan's scooter, admiring Ryan's records, admiring Ryan. But though other girls might have balked at dates that took place in Ryan's garage and consisted entirely of watching him pore over the engine of a scooter, eulogizing its intricacies and complexities, to Clara there was nothing more thrilling. She learnt quickly that Ryan was a man of painfully few words, and that the rare conversations they had would only ever concern Ryan. His hopes, his fears, all scooter-related, and his peculiar belief that he and his scooter would not live long. For some reason, Ryan was convinced of the aging 50s motto, live fast, die young. And, though his scooter didn't do more than 22 miles an hour downhill, he liked to warn Clara in grim tones not to get too involved, for he wouldn't be here long. He was going out, early, and with a bang. She imagined herself holding the bleeding Ryan in her arms, hearing him finally declare his undying love. She saw herself as Mod Widow, wearing black polo necks for a year, and demanding Waterloo Sunset be played at his funeral. Clara's inexplicable dedication to Ryan Topps knew no bounds. It transcended his bad looks, tedious personality, and unsightly personal habits. Essentially, it transcended Ryan. For whatever Hortense claimed, Clara was a teenage girl like any other. The object of her passion was only an accessory to the passion itself, a passion that through its long suppression was now asserting itself with volcanic necessity. Over the ensuing months, Clara's mind changed, Clara's clothes changed, Clara's walk changed, Clara's soul changed. All over the world, girls were calling this change Donny Osmond or Michael Jackson or the Bay City Rollers. Clara chose to call it Ryan Topps. There were no dates in the normal sense, no flowers or restaurants, movies or parties. Occasionally, when more weed was required, Ryan would take her to visit a large squat in North London where an eighth came cheap and people too stoned to make out the features on your face acted like your best friends. Here, Ryan would ensconce himself in a hammock and, after a few joints, progress from his usual monosyllabic to the entirely catatonic. Clara, who didn't smoke, sat at his feet, admired him, and tried to keep up with the general conversation around her. She had no tales to tell like the others, not like Merlin, like Clive, like Leo, Petronia, 1C, and the others. No anecdotes of LSD trips and police brutality or marching on Trafalgar Square. But Clara made friends. A resourceful girl, she used what she had to amuse and terrify an assorted company of hippies, flakes, freaks, and funky folk. A different kind of extremity. Tales of hellfire and damnation, of the devil's love of feces, his passion for stripping skin, for red-hot pokering eyeballs, and the flaying of genitals. All the elaborate plans of Lucifer, that most exquisite of fallen angels, that were set for 1 January 1975. Naturally, the thing called Ryan Topps began to push the end of the world further and further into the back rooms of Clara's consciousness. So many other things were presenting themselves to her. So much new in life. If it were possible, she felt like one of the anointed right now, right here in Lambeth. The more blessed she felt on earth, the more rarely she turned her thoughts towards heaven. In the end, it was the epic feat of long division that Clara simply couldn't figure. So many unsaved. Out of 8 million Jehovah's Witnesses, only 144,000 men could join Christ in heaven. The good women and good enough men would gain paradise on earth. Not a bad booby prize, all things considered. But that still left a few million who failed to make the grade. Add that to the heathens, to the Jews, Catholics, Muslims, to the poor jungle men in the Amazon whom Clara had wept for as a child. So many unsaved. The Witnesses prided themselves on the absence of hell in their theology. The punishment was torture, unimaginable torture on the final day. And then the grave was the grave. But to Clara, this seemed worse. The thought of the great crowd enjoying themselves in earthly paradise while the tortured, mutilated skeletons of the lost lay just under the topsoil. On the one side stood all the mammoth quantities of people on the globe, unacquainted with the teachings of the Watchtower, some with no access to a postbox, unable to contact the Lambeth Kingdom Hall and receive helpful reading material about the road to redemption. On the other side, Hortense, her hair all wrapped up in iron rollers, tossing and turning in her sheets, gleefully awaiting the rains of sulphur to pour down upon the sinners, particularly the woman at number 53. Hortense tried to explain, "Dem that died without the knowing the Lord will be resurrected, and dem will have another chance." But to Clara, it was still an inequitable equation. Unbalanceable books. Faith is hard to achieve, easy to lose. She became more and more reluctant to leave the impress of her knees in the red cushions in the Kingdom Hall. She would not wear sashes, carry banners, or give out leaflets. She would not tell anyone about missing steps. She discovered dope, forgot the staircase, and began taking the lift. 1 October 1974. A detention. Held back 45 minutes after school for claiming in a music lesson that Roger Daltrey was a greater musician than Johann Sebastian Bach, and as a result, Clara missed her 4 o'clock meeting with Ryan on the corner of Leenan Street. It was freezing cold and getting dark by the time she got out. She ran through piles of putrefying autumn leaves, searched the length and breadth of Leenan, but there was no sign. It was with dread that she approached her own front door, offering up to God a multitude of silent contracts. "I'll never have sex. I'll never smoke another joint. I'll never wear another skirt above the knee." If only he could assure her that Ryan Topps had not rung her mother's doorbell looking for shelter from the wind.
"Clara, come out of the cold."
It was the voice Hortense put on when she had company, an overcompensation of all the consonants, the voice she used for pastors and white women. Clara closed the front door behind her and walked in a kind of terror through the living room, past the framed hologram of Jesus who wept and then didn't, and into the kitchen. "Dear Lord, you look like something the cat dragged in." "Mmm," said Ryan, who was happily shoveling a plate of ackee and saltfish into his mouth on the other side of the tiny kitchen table. Clara stuttered, her buck teeth cutting shapes into her bottom lip. "What are you doing here?"
"Ha!" cried Hortense, almost triumphant.
"You think you can hide your friends from me forever? The boy was cold. I let him in. We've been having a nice chat, haven't we, young man?"
Yes, Mrs. Bowden."
"Well, don't look so shocked. You'd think I was going to eat him up or something, eh, Ryan?"
said Hortense, glowing in a manner Clara had never seen before.
"Yeah, right,"
smirked Ryan, and together, Ryan Topps and Clara's mother began to laugh. Is there anything more likely to take the shine off an affair than when the lover strikes up a convivial relationship with the lovee's mother? As the nights got darker and shorter, and it became harder to pick Ryan out of the crowd who milled outside the school gates each day at 3:30, a dejected Clara would make the long walk home, only to find her lover once more in the kitchen, chatting happily with Hortense, devouring the Bowden household's cornucopia of goodies, ackee and saltfish, beef jerky, chicken rice and peas, ginger cake and coconut ices. These conversations, lively as they sounded when Clara turned the key in the door, always fell silent as she approached the kitchen. Like children caught out, they would become sullen, then awkward. Then Ryan would make his excuses and leave. There was also a look, she noticed, that they had begun to give her, a look of sympathy, of condescension, and not only that, they began to comment on her clothing, which had become steadily more youthful, more colourful. And Ryan? What was happening to Ryan? Shed his polo neck, avoided her in school, bought a tie. Of course, like the mother of a drug addict or the neighbour of a serial killer, Clara was the last to know. She had once known everything about Ryan, before Ryan himself knew it. She had been a Ryan expert. Now she was reduced to overhearing the Irish girls assert that Clara Bowden and Ryan Topps were not dealing with each other, definitively, definitely not dealing with each other. Oh no, not anymore. If Clara realized what was happening, she wouldn't allow herself to believe it. On the occasion she spotted Ryan at the kitchen table surrounded by leaflets, and Hortense hurriedly gathering them up and shoving them into her apron pocket, Clara willed herself to forget it. Later that month, when Clara persuaded a doleful Ryan to go through the motions with her in the disabled toilet, she squinted so she couldn't see what she didn't want to see. But it was there, underneath his jumper. There, as he leant back on the sink, was the glint of silver, its gleam hardly visible in the dismal light. It couldn't be, but it was. The silver glint of a tiny silver cross. It couldn't be, but it was. That is how people describe a miracle. Somehow, the opposites of Hortense and Ryan had met at their logical extremes, their mutual predilection for the pain and death of others meeting like perspective points on some morbid horizon. Suddenly the saved and the unsaved had come a miraculous full circle. Hortense and Ryan were now trying to save her. Get on the bike. Clara had just stepped out of school into the dusk. And it was Ryan, his scooter coming to a sharp halt at her feet. Claz, get on the bike.
Go ask my mother if she won't get on the bike.
Please, said Ryan, proffering the spare scooter helmet.
It's important. Need to talk to you. Ain't much time left.
Why? Snapped Clara, rocking petulantly on her platform heels.
You going someplace?
You and me both, murmured Ryan. The right place, hopefully.
No. Please, Claz. No. Please. It's important. Life or death. Man. All right. But me now wearing that thing.
She passed back the helmet and got astride the scooter.
Not mussing up me here.
Ryan drove her across London and up to Hampstead Heath, the very top of Parliament Hill, where, looking down from that peak onto the sickly orange fluorescence of the city, carefully, tortuously, and in language that was not his own, he put forward his case, the bottom line of which was this. There was only a month until the end of the world.
And the thing is, herself and myself, we're just... we. Your mum and myself, mumbled Ryan. We're worried about you. There ain't that many what will survive the last days. You've been with a bad crowd, Claz. Man... said Clara, shaking her head and sucking her teeth. I don't believe this business. Them were your friends. No, they ain't. Not no more. The weed is evil. And all that lot. 1C, Petronia. They're my friends. They ain't nice girls, Clara. They should be with their families, not dressing like they do and doing things with them men in the house. You yourself shouldn't be doing that neither. And dressing like...
Like what?
Like a whore,
said Ryan, the word exploding from him like it was a relief to be rid of it.
Like a loose woman, Oh, boy, I heard everything now. Take me home, man.
They're going to get theirs,
said Ryan, nodding to himself, his arms stretched and gesturing over London from Chiswick to Archway.
There's still time for you. Who do you want to be with, Class? Who do you want to be with? With the 144,000 in heaven ruling with Christ? Or do you want to be one of the great crowd, living in earthly paradise, which is all right, but... Or are you going to be one of them who get it in the neck, torture and death, eh?
I'm just separating the sheep from the goats, Class. The sheep from the goats. That's Matthew. And I think you yourself are a sheep, innit?
Let me tell you something, said Clara, walking back over to the scooter and taking the back seat. I'm a goat. I like being a goat. I wanna be a goat. And I'd rather be sizzling in the rains of sulfur with my friends than sitting in heaven, bored to tears with Darkus, my mother, and you.
Shouldn't have said that, Class, said Ryan solemnly, putting his helmet on. I really wish you hadn't said that, for your sake. He can hear us.
And I'm tired of hearing you. Take me home.
It's the truth. He can hear us, he shouted, turning backwards, yelling above the exhaust pipe noise as they revved up and scooted downhill. He can see it all. He watches over us.
Watch over where you're going,
Clara yelled back as they sent a cluster of Hasidic Jews running in all directions.
Watch the path. Only the few. That's what it says. Only the few. They'll all get it. That's what it says in Deuteronomy. They'll all get what's coming, and only the few.
Somewhere in the middle of Ryan Topps's enlightening biblical exegesis, his former false idol, the Vespa GS, cracked right into a 400-year-old oak tree. Nature triumphed over the presumptions of engineering. The tree survived. The bike died. Ryan was hurled one way, Clara the other. The principles of Christianity and Sod's Law, also known as Murphy's Law, are the same. Everything happens to me for me. So, if a man drops a piece of toast and it lands butter side down, this unlucky event is interpreted as being proof of an essential truth about bad luck, that the toast fell as it did just to prove to you, Mr. Unlucky, that there is a defining force in the universe and it is bad luck. It's not random. It could never have fallen on the right side, so the argument goes, because that's Sod's Law. In short, Sod's Law happens to you to prove to you that there is Sod's Law. Yet, unlike gravity, it is a law that does not exist whatever happens. When the toast lands on the right side, Sod's Law mysteriously disappears. Likewise, when Clara fell, knocking the teeth out of the top of her mouth, while Ryan stood up without a scratch, Ryan knew it was because God had chosen Ryan as one of the saved and Clara as one of the unsaved, not because one was wearing a helmet and the other wasn't. And had it happened the other way round, had gravity reclaimed Ryan's teeth and sent them rolling down Primrose Hill like tiny enamel snowballs, well, you can bet your life that God, in Ryan's mind, would have done a vanishing act. As it was, this was the final sign Ryan needed. When New Year's Eve rolled around, he was there in the living room, sitting in the middle of a circle of candles with Hortense, ardently praying for Clara's soul, while Darkus pissed into his tube and watched the Generation Game on BBC One. Clara, meanwhile, had put on a pair of yellow flares and a red halter neck top and gone to a party. She suggested its theme, helped to paint the banner and hang it from the window. She danced and smoked with the rest of them and felt herself, without undue modesty, to be quite the belle of the squat. But as midnight inevitably came and went without the horseman of the apocalypse making an appearance, Clara surprised herself by falling into a melancholy. For ridding oneself of faith is like boiling seawater to retrieve the salt. Something is gained, but something is lost. Though her friends Merlin, 1C, et al., clapped her on the back and congratulated her for exercising those fervid dreams of perdition and redemption, Clara quietly mourned the warmer touch she had waited for these 19 years, the all-enveloping bear hug of the Saviour, the one who was Alpha and Omega, both the beginning and the end, the man who was meant to take her away from all this, from the listless reality of life in a ground-floor flat in Lambeth. What now for Clara? Ryan would find another fad. Darkus need only turn to the other channel. For Hortense, another date would of course materialize, along with more leaflets, ever more faith. But Clara was not like Hortense. Yet a residue, left over from the evaporation of Clara's faith, remained. She still wished for a saviour. She still wished for a man to whisk her away, to choose her above others so that she might walk in white with him. For she was worthy. Revelation 3:4. Perhaps it is not so inexplicable, then, that when Clara Bowden met Archie Jones at the bottom of some stairs the next morning, she saw more in him than simply a rather short, rather chubby, middle-aged white man in a badly tailored suit. Clara saw Archie through the grey-green eyes of loss. Her world had just disappeared. The face she lived by had receded like a low tide, and Archie, quite by accident, had become the bloke in the joke, the last man on earth. 3. Two Families. It is better to marry than to burn, says Corinthians 1, chapter 7, verse 9. Good advice. Of course, Corinthians also informs us that we should not muzzle the ox while it is treading out the grain, so go figure. By February 1975, Clara had deserted the church and all its biblical literalism for Archibald Jones, but she was not yet the kind of carefree atheist who could laugh near altars or entirely dismiss the teachings of St. Paul. The second dictum wasn't a problem. Having no ox, she was excluded by proxy, but the first was giving her sleepless nights. Was it better to marry? Even if the man was a heathen? There was no way of knowing. She was living without props now, sans safety net. More worrying than God was her mother. Hortense was fiercely opposed to the affair, on grounds of colour rather than of age, and on hearing of it, had promptly ostracised her daughter one morning on the doorstep. Clara still felt that deep down her mother would prefer her to marry an unsuitable man rather than live with him in sin. So she did it on impulse, and begged Archie to take her as far away from Lambeth as a man of his means could manage, Morocco, Belgium, Italy. Archie had clasped her hand and nodded and whispered sweet nothings in the full knowledge that the furthest a man of his means was going was a newly acquired, heavily mortgaged, two-story house in Willesden Green. But no need to mention that now, he felt. Not right now in the heat of the moment. Let her down gently, like. 3 months later, Clara had been gently let down, and here they were, moving in. Archie scrambling up the stairs, as usual cursing and blinding, wilting under the weight of boxes which Clara could carry 2, 3 at a time without effort. Clara taking a break, squinting in the warm May sunshine, trying to get her bearings. She peeled down to a little purple vest and leant against her front gate. What kind of a place was this? That was a thing, you see, you couldn't be sure. Travelling in the front passenger seat of the removal van, she'd seen the high road, and it had been ugly and poor and familiar, though there were no kingdom halls or Episcopalian churches. But then at the turn of a corner, suddenly roads had exploded in greenery, beautiful oaks. The houses got taller, wider, and more detached. She could see parks. She could see libraries. And then abruptly, the trees would be gone, reverting back into bus stops, as if by the strike of some midnight bell, a signal which the houses too obeyed, transforming themselves into smaller, stairless dwellings that sat splay opposite derelict shopping arcades, those peculiar lines of establishments that include without exception. One defunct sandwich bar still advertising breakfast, one locksmith uninterested in marketing frills, keys cut here, and one permanently shut unisex hair salon, the proud bearer of some unspeakable pun, uppercuts or fringe benefits or hair today, gone tomorrow. It was a lottery driving along like that, looking out, not knowing whether one was about to settle down for life amongst the trees or amidst the shit. Then finally the van had slowed down in front of a house, an ice house, somewhere midway between the trees and the shit, and Clara had felt a tide of gratitude roll over her. It was nice. Not as nice as she had hoped, but not as bad as she had feared. It had 2 small gardens front and back, a doormat, a doorbell, a toilet inside, and she had not paid a high price. Only love. Just love. And whatever Corinthians might say, love is not such a hard thing to forfeit. Not if you've never really felt it. She did not love Archie, but had made up her mind from that first moment on the steps to devote herself to him if he would take her away. And now he had. and though it wasn't Morocco or Belgium or Italy, it was nice. Not the promised land, but nice. Nicer than anywhere she'd ever been. Clara understood that Archibald Jones was no romantic hero. 3 months spent in one stinking room in Cricklewood had been sufficient revelation. Oh, he could be affectionate and sometimes even charming. He could whistle a clear, crystal note first thing in the morning. He drove calmly and responsibly, and he was a surprisingly competent cook. But romance was beyond him. Passion, unthinkable. And if you were saddled with a man as average as this, Clara felt, he should at least be utterly devoted to you, to your beauty, to your youth. That's the least he could do to make up for things. But not Archie. 1 month into their marriage, and he already had that funny, glazed look men have when they're looking through you. He had already reverted back into his bachelorhood. Pints with Samad Iqbal, dinner with Samad Iqbal, Sunday breakfasts with Samad Iqbal. Every spare moment with the man in that bloody place, O'Connell's, in that bloody dive. She tried to be reasonable. She asked him, "Why are you never here? Why do you spend so much time with the Indian?" But a pat on the back, a kiss on the cheek, he's grabbing his coat, his foot's out the door, and always the same old answer. "Me and Sam, we go way back." She couldn't argue with that. They went back to before she was born. No white knight then, this Archibald Jones. No aims, no hopes, no ambitions. A man whose greatest pleasures were English breakfasts and DIY. A dull man. An old man. And yet, good. He was a good man. And good might not amount to much. Good might not light up a life. But it is something. She spotted it in him that first time on the stairs. Simply, directly. The same way she could point out a good mango on a Brixton stall without so much as touching the skin. These were the thoughts Clara clung to as she leant on her garden gate, 3 months after her wedding, silently watching the way her husband's brow furrowed and shortened like an accordion, the way his stomach hung pregnant over his belt, the whiteness of his skin, the blueness of his veins, the way his 11s were up, those two ropes of flesh that appear on a man's gullet, so they said in Jamaica, when his time was drawing to a close. Clara frowned. She hadn't noticed these afflictions at the wedding. Why not? He had been smiling and he wore a white polo neck, but no, that wasn't it. She hadn't been looking for them then. That was it. Clara had spent most of her wedding day looking at her feet. It had been a hot day, 14 February, but unusually warm, and there had been a wait because the world had wanted to marry that day in a little registry office on Ludgate Hill. Clara remembered slipping off the petite brown heels she was wearing and placing her bare feet on the chilly floor, making sure to keep them firmly planted either side of a dark crack in the tile, a balancing act upon which she had randomly staked her future happiness. Archie, meanwhile, had wiped some moisture from his upper lip and cursed a persistent sunbeam that was sending a trickle of salty water down his inside leg. For his second marriage, he had chosen a mohair suit with a white polo neck, and both were proving problematic. The heat prompted rivulets of sweat to spring out all over his body, seeping through the polo neck to the mohair, and giving off an unmistakable odour of damp dog. Clara, of course, was all cat. She wore a long brown woolen Jeff Banks dress and a perfect set of false teeth. The dress was backless, the teeth were white, and the overall effect was feline, a pamper in evening dress. Where the wool stopped and Clara's skin started was not clear to the naked eye, and, like a cat, she responded to the dusty sunbeam that was coursing through a high window onto the waiting couples. She warmed her bare back in it. She almost seemed to unfurl. Even the registrar, who had seen it all, horsey women marrying weaselly men, elephantine men marrying owlish women, raised an eyebrow at this most unnatural of unions as they approached his desk. Cat and dog. "Hello, father," said Archie. "He's a registrar, Archibald, you old flake," said his friend Samad Mia Iqbal, who, along with his wife Alsana, had been called in from the exile of the wedding guest room to witness the contract. "Not a Catholic priest." "Right, of course. Sorry. Nervous." The stuffy registrar said, "Shall we get on? We've got a lot of you to get through today." This and little more had constituted the ceremony. Archie was passed a pen and put down his name, Alfred Archibald Jones, nationality, English, and age, 47. Hovering for a moment over the box entitled Occupation, he decided upon Advertising, brackets printed leaflets, then signed himself away. Clara wrote down her name, Clara Ephigenia Bowden, nationality, Jamaican, and age, 19. Finding no box interested in her occupation, she went straight for the decisive dotted line, swept her pen across it, and straightened up again. A Jones. A Jones like no other that had come before her. Then they'd gone outside, onto the steps, where a breeze lifted second-hand confetti and swept it over new couples, where Clara met her only wedding guests formally for the first time. Two Indians, both dressed in purple silk. Samad Iqbal, a tall, handsome man with the whitest teeth and a dead hand, who kept patting her on the back with the one that worked. "My idea this, you know," he repeated again and again. "My idea, all this marriage business. I have known the old boy since... when?" 1945, Sam. "That's what I'm trying to tell your lovely wife. 1945. When you know a man that long, and you fought alongside him, then it's your mission to make him happy if he is not. And he wasn't. Quite the opposite until you made an appearance. Wallowing in the shit heap, if you will pardon the French. Thankfully, she's all packed off now. There's only one place for the mad, and that's with others like them," said Samad, losing steam halfway through the sentence, for Clara clearly had no idea what he was talking about. "Anyway, no need to dwell on. My idea, though, you know, all this." And then there was his wife, Alsana, who was tiny and tight-lipped and seemed to disapprove of Clara somehow, though she could only be a few years older. Said only, "Oh, yes, Mrs. Jones," or, "Oh, no, Mrs. Jones," making Clara so nervous, so sheepish, she felt compelled to put her shoes back on. Archie felt bad for Clara that it wasn't a bigger reception, but there was no one else to invite. All other relatives and friends had declined the wedding invitation, some tersely, some horrified. Others, thinking silence the best option, had spent the past week studiously stepping over the mail and avoiding the phone. The only well-wisher was Ibelgaufts, who had neither been invited nor informed of the event, but from whom, curiously, a note arrived in the morning mail. 14 February, 1975. Dear Archibald, usually there is something about weddings that brings out the misanthrope in me, but today, as I attempted to save a bed of petunias from extinction, I felt a not inconsiderable warmth at the thoughts of the union of one man and one woman in lifelong cohabitation. It is truly remarkable that we humans undertake such an impossible feat, don't you think? But to be serious for a moment, as you know, I am a man whose profession it is to look deep inside of woman, and, like a psychiatrist, mark her with a full bill of health or otherwise. And I feel sure, my friend, to extend a metaphor, that you have explored your lady wife-to-be in such a manner, both spiritually and mentally, and found her not lacking in any particular, and so what else can I offer but the hearty congratulations of your earnest competitor, Horst Ibelgaufts? What other memories of that day could make it unique and lift it out of the other 355 that made up 1975? Clara remembered a young black man stood atop an apple crate, sweating in a black suit, who began pleading to his brothers and sisters, an old bag lady retrieving a carnation from the bin to put in her hair. But then it was all over. The cling film sandwiches Clara had made had been forgotten and sat suffering at the bottom of a bag. The sky had clouded over. And when they walked up the hill to the King Lud pub, past the jeering Fleet Street lads with their Saturday pints, it was discovered that Archie had been given a parking ticket. So it was that Clara spent the first 3 hours of married life in Cheapside Police Station, her shoes in her hands, watching her saviour argue relentlessly with the traffic inspector, who failed to understand Archie's subtle interpretation of the Sunday parking laws. "Clara, Clara, love." It was Archie, struggling past her to the front door, partly obscured by a coffee table. "We've got the Iqbals coming round tonight, and I want to get this house in some kind of order, so mind out the way." "You want help?" asked Clara patiently, though still half in daydream. "I can lift something if..." No, I'll manage." Clara reached out to take one side of the table. "Let me just..." Archie battled to push through the narrow frame, trying to hold both the legs and the table's large removable glass top. "It's man's work, love." "But..." Clara lifted a large armchair with enviable ease and brought it over to where Archie had collapsed, gasping for breath, on the hall steps.
"It's no problem. If you want help, just ask for it."
She brushed her hand softly across his forehead.
"Yes, yes, yes."
He shook her off in irritation, as if batting a fly. "I'm quite capable, you know."
"I know that. It's man's work." "Yes, yes, I see. I didn't mean..."
"Look," Clara laughed. "Just get out of my way and I'll get on with it, okay?" Clara watched him roll up his sleeves with some determination and tackle the coffee table once more. "If you really want to be of some help, love, you can start bringing in some of your clothes. God knows there's enough of them to sink a bloody battleship. How we're going to fit them in what little space we have, I'm sure I don't know."
"I say before, we can throw some of them out if you think it best."
"Not up to me now, not up to me, is it? I mean, is it? And what about the coat stand?" This was the man, never able to make a decision, never able to state a position.
"I already say, if you not like it, then send the damn thing back. I bought it 'cause I thought you like it."
"Well, love," said Archie, cautious now that she'd raised her voice, "it was my money. It would be nice at least to ask my opinion."
"Man, it's a coat stand. It just red, and red is red is red. What's wrong with red all of a sudden?"
"I'm just trying," said Archie, lowering his voice to a hoarse, forced whisper, a favourite voice weapon in the marital arsenal, not in front of the neighbours, children, "to lift the tone in the house a bit. This is a nice neighbourhood, new life, you know. Look, let's not argue. Let's flip a coin. Heads it stays, tails." True lovers row, then fall the next second back into each other's arms. More seasoned lovers will walk up the stairs or into the next room before they relent and retrace their steps. A relationship on the brink of collapse will find one partner two blocks down the road or two countries to the east before something tugs, some responsibility, some memory, a pull of a child's hand or a heartstring, which induces them to make the long journey back to their other half. On this Richter scale, then, Clara made only the tiniest of rumbles. She turned towards the gate, walked two steps only, and stopped. "Heads," said Archie, seemingly without resentment. "It stays. See? That wasn't too hard."
"I don't want to argue."
She turned round to face him, having made a silent renewed resolution to remember her debt to him.
"You said the Iqbals are coming to dinner. I was just thinking if they're going to want me to cook them some curry. I mean, I can cook curry, but it's my type of curry."
"For God's sake, they're not those kind of Indians," said Archie irritably, offended at the suggestion. "Sam will have Sunday roast like the next man. He serves Indian food all the time. He doesn't want to eat it too."
"I was just wondering..."
"Well, don't. Clara, please." He gave her an affectionate kiss on the forehead, for which she bent downwards a little. "I've known Sam for years, and his wife seems a quiet sort. They're not the royal family, you know. They're not those kind of Indians," he repeated, and shook his head, troubled by some problem, some knotty feeling he could not entirely unravel. Samad and Alsana Iqbal, who were not those kind of Indians, as, in Archie's mind, Clara was not that kind of black, who were, in fact, not Indian at all but Bangladeshi, lived four blocks down on the wrong side of Willesden High Road. It had taken them a year to get there, a year of mercilessly hard graft, to make the momentous move from the wrong side of Whitechapel to the wrong side of Willesden. A year's worth of Alsana banging away at the old singer that sat in the kitchen, sewing together pieces of black plastic for a shop called Domination in Soho. Many were the nights Alsana would hold up a piece of clothing she had just made, following the pattern she was given, and wonder what on earth it was. A year's worth of Samad softly inclining his head at exactly the correct deferential angle, pencil in his left hand, listening to the appalling pronunciation of the British, Spanish, American, French, Australian.
"Go buy Elo Sag, please. Chicken gel fritzy with chips, thanks."
From 6 in the evening until 3 in the morning, and then every day was spent asleep, until daylight was as rare as a decent tip. For what is the point, Samad would think, pushing aside 2 mints and a receipt to find 15 pence, what is the point of tipping a man the same amount you'd throw in a fountain to chase a wish? But before the illegal thought of folding the 15 pence discreetly in his napkin hand even had a chance to give itself form, Mukul, Ardeshir Mukul, who ran the palace, and whose wiry frame paced the restaurant, one benevolent eye on the customers, one ever-watchful eye on the staff, Mukul was upon him.
Samad. He had a cloying, oleaginous way of speaking. Did you kiss the necessary backside this evening, cousin?
Samad and Ardishir were distant cousins, Samad the elder by 6 years. With what joy, pure bliss, had Ardishir opened the letter last January, to find his older, cleverer, handsomer cousin was finding it hard to get work in England. And could he possibly—
15 pence, cousin, said Samad, lifting his palm.
Well, every little helps. Every little helps, said Ardishir, his dead fish lips stretching into a stringy smile. Into the piss-pot with it.
The piss-pot was a black balti pot that sat on a plinth outside the staff toilets, and into which all tips were pooled and then split at the end of the night. For the younger, flashy, good-looking waiters like Shiva, this was a great injustice. Shiva was the only Hindu on the staff. This stood as tribute to his waitering skills, which had triumphed over religious differences. Shiva could make a 4-quid tip in an evening if the blubberous white divorcee in the corner was lonely enough, and he batted his long lashes at her effectively. He could also make his money out of the polar neck directors and producers. The palace sat in the centre of London's theatreland, and these were still the days of the royal court, of pretty boys and kitchen sink drama, who flattered the boy, watched his ass wiggle provocatively to the bar and back, and swore that if anyone ever adapted a passage to India for the stage, he could have whichever role tickled his fancy. For Shiva, then, the pisspot system was simply daylight robbery and an insult to his unchallenged waitering abilities. But for men like Samad, in his late 40s, and for the even older, like the white-haired Muhammad, Ardishir's great-uncle, who was 80 if he was a day, who had deep pathways dug into the sides of his mouth where he had smiled when he was young, for men like this, the pisspot could not be complained about. It made more sense to join the collective than pocket 15 pence and risk being caught and Dr. Weeks' tips.
You roll on my back!
Shiva would snarl when he had to relinquish £5 at the end of the night and drop it into the pot.
You all live off my back. Somebody get these losers off my back. That was my fiver, and now it's going to be split 65 fucking million ways as a handout to these losers. What is this? Communism?
And the rest would avoid his glare and busy themselves quietly with other things until one evening, one 15 pence evening, Samaj said,
"Shut up, boy." Quietly, almost under his breath.
You!
Shiva swung round to where Samad stood, crushing a great tub of lentils for tomorrow's dal.
You're the worst of them! You're the worst fucking waiter I've ever seen! You couldn't get a tip if you mugged the bastards! I hear you trying to talk to the customer about biology this, politics that. Just serve the food, you idiot! You're a waiter for fuck's sake, you're not Michael Parkinson! Did I hear you say deli?
Shiva put his apron over his arm and began posturing around the kitchen. It was a pitiful mimic.
I was there myself, you know. Delhi University. It was most fascinating, yes. And I fought in the war for England. Yes, yes. Yes, charming, charming.
Round and round the kitchen he went, bending his head and rubbing his hands over and over like Uriah Heep, bowing and genuflecting to the head cook, to the old man, arranging great hunks of meat in the walk-in freezer, to the young boy scrubbing the underside of the oven. Samad, Samad, he said with what seemed infinite pity, then stopped abruptly, pulling the apron off and wrapped it round his waist. You are such a sad little man. Muhammad looked up from his pot scrubbing and shook his head again and again. To no one in particular, he said,
These young people, what kind of talk? What kind of talk? What happened to respect? What kind of talk is this?
And you can fuck off too, said Shiva, brandishing a ladle in his direction.
You old fool. You're not my father.
Second cousin of your mother's uncle, a voice muttered from the back.
Bollocks, said Shiva. Bollocks to that.
He grabbed the mop and was heading off for the toilets when he stopped by Samad and placed the handle inches from Samad's mouth.
Kiss it, he sneered, and then impersonating Ardishir's sluggish drawl,
Who knows, cousin, you might get a rise.
And that's what it was like most nights. Abuse from Shiva and others, condescension from Ardishir, never seeing Alsana, never seeing the sun, clutching 15 pence and then releasing it, wanting desperately to be wearing a sign, a large white placard that said, I am not a waiter. I have been a student, a scientist, a soldier. My wife is called Alsana. We live in East London, but we would like to move north. I am a Muslim, but Allah has forsaken me, or I have forsaken Allah. I am not sure. I have a friend, Archie, and others. I am 49, but women still turn in the street. Sometimes. But no such placard existing. He had instead the urge, the need, to speak to every man, and, like the Ancient Mariner, explain, constantly, constantly wanting to reassert something, anything. Wasn't that important? But then the heartbreaking disappointment, to find out that inclining of one's head, poising of one's pen, these were important, so important. It was important to be a good waiter, to listen when someone said, lamb dawn sock and rice with chips, thank you. And 15 pence clinked on china. Thank you, sir. Thank you so very much. On the Tuesday after Archie's wedding, Samad had waited till everyone left, folded his white flared trousers made from the same fabric as the tablecloths into a perfect square, and then climbed the stairs to Ardashir's office, for he had something to ask him. Cousin, said Ardashir with a friendly grimace at the sight of Samad's body curling cautiously round the door. He knew that Samad had come to inquire about a pay increase, and he wanted his cousin to feel that he had at least considered the case in all his friendly judiciousness before he declined.
Cousin, come in.
Good evening, Ardashir Mukul, said Samad, stepping fully into the room.
Sit down, said Ardashir warmly. No point standing on ceremony now, is there?
Samad was glad this was so. He said as much. He took a moment to look with the necessary admiration around the room, with its relentless gold, with its triple-piled carpet, with its furnishings in various shades of yellow and green. One had to admire Ardashir's business sense. He had taken the simple idea of an Indian restaurant, small room, pink tablecloth, loud music, atrocious wallpaper, meals that do not exist in India, sauce carousel, and just made it bigger. He hadn't improved anything. Everything was the same old crap, but it was all bigger, in a bigger building, in the biggest tourist trap in London, Leicester Square. You had to admire it and admire the man, who sat now like a benign locust, his slender, insectile body swamped in a black leather chair, leaning over the desk, all smiles, a parasite disguised as a philanthropist.
Cousin, what can I do for you?
Samad took a breath. The matter was this. Ardashir's eyes glazed over a little as Samad explained his situation. His skinny legs twitched underneath the desk, and in his fingers he manipulated a paperclip until it looked reasonably like an A. A for Ardashir. The matter was... What was the matter? The house was the matter. Samad was moving out of East London, where one couldn't bring up children. Indeed, one couldn't, not if one didn't wish them to come to bodily harm, he agreed. From East London with its NF gangs to North London, North West, where things were more liberal. Was it his turn to speak?
Cousin, said Ardashir, arranging his face, you must understand. I cannot make it my business to buy houses for all my employees, cousin or not cousin. I pay a wage, cousin. That is business in this country.
Ardashir shrugged as he spoke, as if to suggest he deeply disapproved of business in this country, but there it was. He was forced, his look said, forced by the English to make an awful lot of money. You must understand me, Ardashir. I have the deposit for the house. It is our house now. We have moved in. How on earth has he afforded it? He must work his wife like a bloody slave, thought Ardashir, pulling out another paperclip from the bottom drawer. I need only a small wage increase to help me finance the move, to make things a little easier as we settle in. And Alsana, well, she is pregnant. Pregnant. Difficult. The case called for extreme diplomacy.
Don't mistake me, Samad. We are both intelligent, frank men, and I think I can speak frankly. I know you're not a fucking waiter. He whispered the expletive and smiled indulgently after it, as if it were a naughty private thing that brought them close together. I see your position. Of course I do. But you must understand mine. If I made allowances for every relative I employ, I'd be walking around like bloody Mr. Gandhi, without a pot to piss in, spinning my thread by the light of the moon. An example, At this very moment, that wastrel fat Elvis brother-in-law of mine, Hussein Ishmael, the butcher, demands that I should raise the price I pay for his stinking meat.
But Adisha, we are brothers-in-law, he is saying to me,
and I am saying to him, but Mohammed, this is retail.
It was Samad's turn to glaze over. He thought of his wife, Alsana, who was not as meek as he had assumed when they married, to whom he must deliver the bad news. Alsana, who was prone to moments, even fits, yes, fits was not too strong a word, of rage. Cousins, aunts, brothers thought it a bad sign. They worried if there wasn't some funny mental history in Alsana's family. They sympathized with him the way you sympathize with a man who has bought a stolen car with more mileage on it than first thought. In his naivety, Samad had simply assumed a woman so young would be easy. But Alsana was not. No, she was not easy. It was, he supposed, the way with these young women these days. Archie's bride. Last Tuesday, he had seen something in her eyes that wasn't easy either. It was the new way with these women. Ardisher came to the end of what he felt was his perfectly worded speech, sat back satisfied, and laid the M for McCool he had moulded next to the A for Ardisher that sat on his lap.
Thank you, sir, said Samad. Thank you so very much.
That evening, there was an awful row. Alsana slung the sewing machine with the black-studded hot pan she was working on to the floor.
Useless! Tell me, Samad Mia, what is the point of moving here? Nice house, yes, very nice, very nice. But where is the food?
It is a nice area. We have friends here.
Who are they?
She slammed a little fist onto the kitchen table, sending the salt and pepper flying to collide spectacularly with each other in the air.
I don't know them.
You fight in an old, forgotten war with some Englishman, married to a black.
Whose friends are they?
These are the people my child will grow up around? Their children half blacky white?
But tell me, she shouted, returning to her favoured topic, where is our food?
Theatrically, she threw open every cupboard in the kitchen.
Where is it?
Can we eat china?
Two plates smashed to the floor. She patted her stomach to indicate her unborn child and pointed to the pieces.
Hungry?
Samad, who had an equally melodramatic nature when prompted, yanked open the freezer and pulled out a mountain of meat which he piled in the middle of the room. His mother worked through the night preparing meat for her family, he said. His mother did not, he said, spend the household money, as Alsana did, on prepared meals, yogurts and tinned spaghetti. Alsana punched him full square in the stomach.
Samad Iqbal, the traditionalist. Why don't I just squat in the street over a bucket and wash clothes, eh? In fact, what about my clothes? Edible?
As Samad clutched his windy belly, there in the kitchen she ripped to shreds every stitch she had on and added them to the pile of frozen lamb, spare cuts from the restaurant. She stood naked before him for a moment, the yet small mound of her pregnancy in full view, then put on a long brown coat and left the house. But all the same, she reflected, slamming the door behind her, it was true. It was a nice area. She couldn't deny it as she stormed towards the high road, avoiding trees where previously, in Whitechapel, she avoided flung-out mattresses and the homeless. It would be good for the child. She couldn't deny it. Alsana had a deep-seated belief that living near green spaces was morally beneficial to the young, and there to her right was Gladstone Park, a sweeping horizon of green named after the Liberal Prime Minister. Alsana was from a respected old Bengal family and had read her English history, but look at her now. If they could see what depths. And in the Liberal tradition, it was a park without fences, unlike the more affluent Queen's Park, Victoria's with its pointed metal railings. Wilson was not as pretty as Queen's Park, but it was a nice area, no denying it. Not like Whitechapel, where that madman Enoch somewhere or other gave a speech that forced them into the basement while kids broke the windows with their steel-capped boots. Rivers of blood, silly-billy nonsense. Now she was pregnant, she needed a little bit of peace and quiet. Though it was the same here in a way. They all looked at her strangely, this tiny Indian woman, stalking the high road in her Macintosh, her plentiful hair flying every which way. Marley's Kebabs, Mr. Chung's, Raj's, Malkovich Bakeries. She read the new, unfamiliar signs as she passed. She was shrewd. She saw what this was. Liberal. Hoshkosh nonsense. No one was more liberal than anyone else anywhere anyway. It was only that here, in Wilsdon, there was just not enough of any one thing to gang up against any other thing and send it running to the cellars while windows were smashed.